My name is Arielanis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. In this week's podcast, I am joined by Professor Jamie Smith for a discussion of what we mean when we use the word secular, and how the word secular may be holding us back from really creating an open and pluralistic space to members of all different religious groups. Thank you for listening to Multifaithful, and now to this week's conversation. So, I am joined today by James K.A. Smith, Professor of Philosophy at Calvin College. Jamie, thank you for being here.
It's great to be here.
And joined by one of my chaplains here at NYU, David. How you doing?
Doing all right.
David is one of the chaplains within Traversity, and one of the consistent and really fun presences around the office. And I think one of the first chaplains to appear on the podcast. This is exciting.
It is very exciting. Thanks for having us.
Great. So, Jamie, I wanted to start by discussing a topic we haven't really delved into on the podcast yet so much, which is secularism. At a university, we often think of a university, or at NYU, we think of it as a secular space. But what that means, I think, is different to different people. And so I know you write a lot about secularism, so I was wondering, for an audience that maybe is not as in this discussion and just thinks of NYU, oh, it's NYU's a secular university because it's not affiliated with any religious institution, maybe we can unpack what is a secular institution mean, or what is secular space, and how does that then affect the way religious people express being religious in that space?
No, that's a great question. I think we inherit a sort of default understanding of secular to mean, well, obviously disestablished, right? So it's not run by a religious body or the church or some religious institution. I think then it morphs, however, into, we also assume that the word secular means something like neutral, unbiased, objective, mm-hmm. rational. That's a story that we inherit from a certain kind of Kantian line of thinking that comes out of the Enlightenment. And I suppose what has interested me is how much that second notion, that a secular perspective is a neutral, unbiased, mm-hmm. objective perspective, has been subject to resounding criticism within philosophy over the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. And not just from religious voices, right. Either, right? Like there's been a certain implosion of that kind of claim, so that some have now suggested even that we live in a kind of post-secular context. So if NYU is a pluralist institution, that doesn't mean that it's a space that is neutral and objective and unbiased. It actually means it's a space where people come from multiple perspectives, commitments, confessional standpoints.
So why did this notion of a secular as unbiased or objective, like what about that idea is collapsing in the philosophical realm?
Because in some ways it was predicated on, for example, feminist and post-colonial critiques. So what marched around as capital R reason turned out to be what white male Germans thought, or something like that, right?
Right.
And so it's just the alleged claims to a sort of neutral universal rationality have been subjected to criticism from multiple perspectives. And what's interesting then is how much religious communities and voices actually find alliances in deconstructing that picture of rationality, mm-hmm. in very unlikely friends. So I've done a lot of work on postmodernists like Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida, and I actually, as a religious thinker, I find the postmodern critique of modernity to be sort of opening up spaces for the university to be truly pluralist rather than dogmatically secularist in that sense.
And David, how does this strike you as someone who's, I think you've been on campus and doing chaplain work on campus actually longer than I've been at NYU. And so does this kind of, and as working especially, I know you do work with graduate students and faculty. So how does this dichotomy that we're talking about, or the breakdown of this dichotomy, track with your experience within the NYU ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, most of the students that I'm working with are coming from a particular religious perspective. Most of the Christian or students that I work with are Christians, and so they're coming to this university with a specifically religious standpoint that informs, you know, how they're carrying themselves here. I don't know that they experience NYU, and particularly their time in the classroom, as all that pluralistic in a way. My general sense is that, you know, when you come to a university like this in a big city like this, as pluralistic as the populace might be, once you get into the classroom and start going about the business of working in the classroom, you immediately start working within a philosopher that Jamie draws on quite a bit, Charles Taylor, talks about as the immanent frame. You're talking about things within the framework of just this worldly types of evidence, this worldly types of phenomena, this worldly types of goods, and that sort of sets the parameters for the discussion, so that, you know, all the things that shape the various points of view that make it a pluralistic community are actually kind of bracketed out a lot of times and aren't brought to the table in the discussion in the same way, unless these are specific ideologies or points of view that can be framed within that immanent frame. So maybe feminism, or maybe a sort of socialist sort of perspective. But once you start talking about a robust Jewish perspective, or a robust Hindu perspective, or a robust Christian perspective, those are not necessarily given the time of day within a classroom setting, which is where most of the students, you know, waking working hours are spent.
Mm-hmm. That kind of confirms what I would have expected. I would say, in a way, the habits of mind that characterize the university still haven't caught up to this critique of the kind of dogmatic secularism that was so woven into its ethos for so long, right? And in some ways, I think precisely in an era in which that kind of dogmatic secularist, exclusivist way of framing, you know, public discourse, insofar as that has been criticized, in some ways the response has been to be all the more aggressively dogmatist about our secularism as a response to that. And that's partly understandable. I think you could also see it as kind of the last gasp of somebody saying, why aren't you listening to us? And, you know, we need to be governed by rationality. I just think the very fact that we are in this building called the Center for Global Spirituality at mm-hmm. New York University, to me, is just a fascinating little case study of
right.
why does this building exist at NYU? Why does this institution exist? What's the story that NYU is telling itself such that it needs a space like this?
Yeah, and I actually think that that story is very related to a broader story in higher education, because this building is only 3 years old, and centers for religious life in the American secular university are very new. And I actually spend a fair amount of my time, and I've mentioned this in previous episodes, I get a ton of emails and calls from people at other universities who are saying, we have religious students on our campus and we don't have the right services for them. And then also more fundamentally, like the role that students' religious identities are playing in their bigger educational experience is often left out, and we're not really sure what to do with it. And I think there is an increasing recognition within the higher education world that this needs to be part of it. And it's interesting you say that a lot of this you're tracking to like feminist critique, because I think that in the early stages, a lot of the creation of these like student identity-centered spaces was around LGBT issues
sure.
and around race issues. And now I think we've come to religion as the next in that line of progression. And I do think it's having a big impact on campus more broadly. I think, you know, 15 years ago, the center like this wouldn't have been accepted as broadly. And now it's, you know, it's a building on Washington Square Park of NYU that has 60 chaplains, which is incredible for us. I mean, I get a job out of it, so it's even better
it
for
is,
me.
It's a remarkable phenomenon that signals some change that has taken place. You know, there's a very influential political philosopher in the 20th century named John Rawls,
mm-hmm.
who basically constructed this way of imagining public discourse where everybody had to sort of leave at the door all the particularities of their beliefs and confession and traditions and so on. The irony was, in this allegedly naked public square, it turned out some people got to wear their clothes
right.
because they pretended that they were rational. And I think that's what's been called into question.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, we all come into this pluralistic space. Now, there is another way of thinking about the secular here that might also provide a frame for talking about what happens at a place like NYU. So I've said that in many ways over the last 300 years, we've associated the secular with the neutral and the unbiased and so on. Charles Taylor, who David was just mentioning, has, in his big book, A Secular Age, gives another way of understanding secularity now, which is not this neutrality or a-religiosity or anti-religiosity, but we live in a secular age insofar as we find ourselves in a territory and time in which there are competing ways of believing. So we have a heightened sense that no one's belief is can be taken as axiomatic for any culture or society. We have this sense of the fragilization of belief, he calls it, where, you know, I have neighbors next to me that believe something other than I do. And in a way, the university is almost like a fantastic case study of feeling those cross pressures of competing forms of belief.
Let's say you encounter more diversity in your years at university than probably at any other point in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so intense. And it's not helping if we tell students to pretend that they don't have those things.
Right.
Right? And I think there's something liberating about being able to own up to the particularities of the communities, but also learning the habits of how to now have conversations across those things, which is what you guys are doing here.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to me because I came from like all Jewish schools my entire life until I did my undergrad here at NYU, and NYU was the first time I had ever, like, the first Muslim friend I ever had was at NYU. The first Christian friends I ever really developed were at NYU. And I don't think that experience is so atypical. And I think you're right, that kind of notion of a secular as just opening up this space for pluralism in the first place is really interesting.
And I would say the kind of dogmatic secularists that just want to rule all of that out of the public square, I actually think are insufficiently secular in this second sense, right? They actually don't realize how much their own viewpoints are contestable. And I think if we all sort of start owning up to that, it just changes how we have the conversation. It doesn't exclude us still coming with truth claims from our particular traditions. It just changes the nature of the conversation.
You know, I was really appreciative of that distinction that Taylor draws and that, you know, in your book, book summarizing Taylor, you also draw between, you know, secular two and secular three. You know, secular three, you know, sort of the way I understood that is, you know, we live in a pluralistic society, and so secular three is sort of an sort of a consequence of that, because you're running up against people with other viewpoints, and as you say, our viewpoints are then fragilized because we realize that we have assumptions, we have ways of thinking about things that are open to question, that people, you know, can seem to manage their way in life with very different ways of framing things. And so it injects an element of doubt into you know, our worldview. And so that's, you know, secular three, and that's just sort of the air that we breathe in a pluralistic society. As opposed to secular two, which is more of a normative sort of stance, where we're going to say, this is the way you need to think if you're going to be rational, if you're going to enter into the public square and be able to have dialogue with each other. We need to have neutral common ground that, you know, we enter into. And I guess what I was thinking earlier is that secular too is sort of how we de facto operate in the classroom oftentimes. And then we step outside of the classroom and we walk into a secular three sort of world, but they're not the same thing. And it's not the case that because you live in a secular three world that therefore it's something that you just take for granted that once you walk into the classroom, you have to operate on secular two rules. I mean, what would you think about that?
Yeah, I definitely think our pedagogies in university classrooms have not caught up to these realities. And it's much easier, in a way, to manage a classroom if we just pretend that there is something like a neutral standpoint.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean, I just think that that's actually never true. It's just somebody's standpoint getting to be congratulated as the neutral standpoint. So to deconstruct that is not to therefore say anything goes, or to just create this chaos. We need to think about it in terms of what is a fair conversation, right? What is a charitable conversation? We're still pursuing truth together. I mean, the university has to be about truth seeking. And so we're still after that. There's still commitments involved, but I do think that there's ways to manage that conversation differently, without giving up on the truth claims
part. Right, and I think this is actually, it's interesting because this sort of parallels a similar conversation that I know a lot of students at NYU, and I think has been even more prevalent in Europe now, is about neutrality of public space and what religious identities are able to be expressed in public. And I think the most obvious example of that is women who wear a hijab in France, and rules against that and where it's okay. It's something I'm particularly sensitive to as someone who wears a kippah, and obviously wearing a yarmulke in New York is like totally never an issue. But, you know, when I've gone on trips, people have often asked me, like, will you wear it here? Will you not wear it here? And that's obviously not comparable to the experience of some Muslim people dealing with like real issues. Where, so I'm curious, how does this conversation extend to the way we think about not just our secular universities, but representation in our public spaces in general? Like, how can we be, how can we remove kind of a veneer of neutrality and say, no, we're actually going to construct public spaces that are representative and pluralistic, and that's going to involve what?
It's a great question. The way I would start thinking about it is, so the French model of laïcité is the most dogmatic form of secularism.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also say is the most tied to an Enlightenment project. I mean, it's clearly, it's a revolutionary model, mm-hmm. and it directly comes out of a modernist Enlightenment model. In contrast, for example, I think if you look at other societies, it's actually other societies that maybe even have established religious bodies, like officially mm-hmm. within their constitution, that are better at making room for minority religious expression. So if you take the United Kingdom, for example, so technically the Anglican Church is the established church
right.
of the realm, and yet it's precise, and so some people might think, well, that's got to spell, you know, that's got to be terrible for those who then aren't Anglican. But in fact, what happens is, it's precisely because you have that established role of the church that they are now the champions of religious freedom and religious expression for all traditions, and push back on any of this myth of neutrality that characterizes the public sphere. Now, a province like Quebec in Canada has had a very similar recent debate about religious expression in the public sphere. There, I think, again, what's going on is because they came from an era of the Catholic Church so dominating in
mm-hmm.
domineering ways that the pendulum has swung the other way,
right.
and now they basically want to be France in
mm-hmm.
North America. And somehow we need to talk about what Charles Taylor calls an open secularism, right? So there's, yes, we recognize that there has to be a plurality, that the public space is a contested space, but we do that in a way that is open to admitting the particularities of where people come from. And
yeah.
that, by the way, that doesn't make anything simple or clean or easy.
No, it's so complicated.
It makes it more complicated, but I actually think it's more just,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, it does a better job of welcoming others in ways that are consistent.
Yeah. I mean, it's a challenge, especially I feel like people are most attentive to it during holiday season, right? Because Jon Stewart made his living off of riling up Fox News about the war on Christmas. But I think that what's going on there is a much more nuanced conversation about whose beliefs are represented in the public square and how do we do that in an equitable and just way. And that's like a very difficult question that we in the United States are, I mean, I don't think we're at, I'll make a judgment. I don't think we're as bad as France on this, but we certainly are not perfect. Not everyone is represented.
No, and that goes back, I would say, to certain constitutional decisions that
mm-hmm.
were made in the United States as well. I'd be intrigued. Do you guys see any generational difference on these questions? So do you feel any difference, say, between how faculty think about these things as opposed to students?
It's a great question.
That is a really great question.
I'll say my instinct is yes. I think for a few reasons. I think one of the reasons is that more and more young people are coming from interfaith families, and so their notion of religious expression is just inherently more interfaith than their parents, and so I think they're more inclined to it. I think that's like a small, I don't think that's the whole picture, I think that's a small part. I think as immigration trends change and as people become more accustomed to Muslim people, Buddhist people, Hindu people, Sikh people, who, like my parents, if they had gone to public school, just like wouldn't have met those people. Whereas today, if you go to public school, you're gonna meet. It's just the demographics change. So I think people are more used to it. So the idea of having like Muslim religious symbols up is maybe more acceptable to younger people who just grow up with more visibly Muslim imagery. But you know, I think that's also a perspective that's like biased by being in New York.
Yeah, I was gonna
say. And used to seeing that much diversity all the time. Right. Whereas if you kind of grow up in a town that's more monolithic,
so
right, then
yeah,
then that's totally not your experience.
Yeah,
I would tend to agree with that, but particularly, you know, here in New York, you just, I mean, this is the most diverse city, or I think probably the most diverse city in the country, maybe
mm-hmm.
the world. Probably.
I
want
to give
world.
Some props to Toronto.
Okay, all right. Second to Toronto. And so, you know, you come to a place like this, and you know, you get used to seeing folks, you know, with all sorts of religious expressions, not just you know, in, you know, shaping the way that they think, but also literally worn on their sleeves sometimes, you know, and so you kind of, you're used to that, you're used to the idea of that sort of diversity being there, and kind of knowing that there's a conversation there to be had, and that it might actually be nice to have that conversation. I mean, you know, I'll put it this way. My folks grew up in North Carolina in schools that never integrated. I don't think my parents ever went to school with an African American, with somebody who wasn't at least nominally Christian. And so, you know, their experience has been very different from, you know, mine growing up in the suburbs, still in North Carolina, and still not anywhere near the sort of diversity that you have in New York. But at least there was clearly more religious diversity, and certainly more ethnic diversity and national sort of
yeah.
diversity in my experience growing up than they ever got to experience. And so, and that has to shape the way we
I was curious.
These things.
Sure. Do you think students expect the classroom to be a space where they can have these conversations? Or do they accept the kind of de facto neutralist repertoire of the university that we have perpetuated?
You know, I don't know if they expect it, but they long for it.
Okay.
I think they long for it. I'm thinking especially if there's a group here at NYU, and you know, I'll consider this a plug for them. There's a group called Agora, which Ariel is very familiar with as well. It was put together by a number of, I think, mostly master's in public administration students here in the Wagner School from diverse faith backgrounds. And, you know, my read on why they did this was they wanted to create a space where they could talk about the things that they're engaged in their studies, and the things that they care about, issues of poverty, issues of social justice, the issues that are pressing on our world today. But they wanted to have a space where they could talk about these issues from their various religious perspectives. And that seems to bespeak a lack of that kind of space within the classroom. And so they had to create their own space to have those conversations across difference, and speaking from out of their worldviews, rather than, as you say, checking their faith perspectives at the door to enter into a supposedly neutral academic space. That signals to me that there's a hunger for these conversations to happen, and not just to have interfaith dialogue where Muslims and Christians are going to talk about where they disagree on specifically Islam and Christianity, but rather to say, all right, I'm going to speak as a Muslim, I'm going to speak as a Christian about something that we both care about, and that's you know, a recognized issue for the wider world.
Yeah, I would agree. I think from my own experience, I think I have like a perfect example that encapsulates this. So I studied when I was an undergrad at NYU, I studied Jewish studies and religion. And I, my favorite classes, and I was just obsessed with academic Bible, like academic biblical criticism. I come from a world that are people who are biblical literalists. And so merging those two and figuring out what I believed about the Bible was like a really, really important question for me in college. I took a lot of Bible classes. Not once did I ever discuss belief or how I was thinking about it in the Bible classes. I had a group of friends. There were five of us, later expanded to seven. We called ourselves the Heretics Book Club, and we read books by Jewish philosophers on how to incorporate these two worlds. And we actually, there was one who's based in New York. We went up to meet with him about his book, and we like met weekly for a period of a year and a half and read about all of this stuff. But I was lucky. I had a group of impressively nerdy friends who wanted to do this with me. But, you know, I don't know how typical that experience is. I think you can find analogs to that for a lot of students. But I don't know. The professors I had would not have wanted to have this conversation. I can imagine the class would have been very different and probably what I would have liked to have it. But it would have been a hard conversation to run. It's not an easy one.
Right. Yeah, you need different virtues to manage that kind of classroom. Yeah. And they're not the virtues that we learn in our PhD programs and
right.
the sort of training that we receive, right? You need a certain, it's this interesting blend of courage and vulnerability and how to not let it just spiral into, you know, a kind of shouting fest or just letting people spout off, you know?
So I wanna now transition to one other, I think, really difficult question when we talk about pluralism and a public space and creating a university, which is pluralism is really good at being open to people who have pluralistic beliefs. And by that, what I mean is a religious student who comes in saying, I believe X, but if you believe Y, that's great. You believe Y, I believe X, and like we're both going to continue doing that, so then a pluralistic space fits really well for those two students. The place at NYU where I think that's most difficult, and I know that we talk about this a lot, is people who have exclusive truth claims. So if you believe that the only way to heaven or the only way to salvation is a certain set of beliefs, and there's an analog in every religion has a set of that, and so that belief system is inherently not pluralistic in the way that other people within your pluralistic system are pluralistic. And so how do we create a space that accounts for both of those? Because there's no way you can be open to everyone who's religious except for the religious people who aren't open to everyone else who's to be equally religious,
yeah.
right? That's just not a fair openness. That's not being open to everyone. That's being open to everyone who already agrees with you. So how do we create a public space that is truly open or a university that's truly open for everyone?
Yeah, I'd love to hear how you guys think about this. I think it is sort of the $64 million question.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of it is, it starts by actually getting people to realize that even those who take themselves to be very cosmopolitan and capacious and welcoming, ultimately at some point have some exclusive truth claims that they're not willing
mm-hmm.
to sacrifice. And so maybe just the first move is leveling the playing field a little bit and realizing there's not some who have exclusive truth claims and then others who don't. It's which and what sorts of exclusive truth claims do we have. So then we level that playing field. I know as an admitted, you know, confessed Christian who has those kinds of exclusive truth claims about what I think is sort of the normative call on human
mm-hmm.
beings, I would also say, though, internal to my biblical understanding and Christian worldview are reasons for me to want to learn from others who I disagree with maybe on some fundamental issues, but with whom I share a world and who have insights into that world that I and my tradition might not. So I do think it makes a difference what communities and exclusive claims we're talking about, and maybe not all traditions have the same resources
mm-hmm.
in that regard, but I would think, for example, both in a Jewish and a Christian tradition, we can, from within those exclusive, ultimately exclusive traditions, we have an account of how and why we want to listen to others and actually have something to learn from others. So I think it's not mutually exclusive at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, let's at least not assume that people who have exclusive truth claims don't want to participate in a pluralistic space. I think they do. We might have to agree that there are certain rules of engagement that mm-hmm. we'll agree about in terms of the mode of persuasion that is appropriate to that. And I think we need to maybe realize that not all traditions have internal resources to make sense of that. Mm-hmm. That would be even a harder conversation,
perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, I think certainly, I mean, so again, speaking as a Christian, you know, this really came out in Dr. Smith's talk last night for the Veritas Forum, that a Christian worldview carried out consistently should lead us into a sort of cosmopolitan posture, sort of a posture of creating room for people who disagree with us, others, recognizing that they also are bearers of the divine image, and that it is beneath their dignity for us to try and strong-arm them into a sort of false agreement, a pretended agreement with us, that it's only right to try to persuade people, but that's a different sort of thing. That's a respect for somebody's rationality, for somebody's perspective, for somebody's history, and just for somebody's agency in the world. And so if you have different traditions that have the resources for saying that we're going to come to the table and we're going to respect each other as rational agents, although with different perspectives, and that the rules of the game are always we're going to try and persuade each other and actually have a conversation rather than we're going to try and strong-arm each other or we're just going to browbeat each other. If you have those sorts of perspectives coming out of the different religious worldviews, then I think you can have a really healthy pluralistic space on a university campus. And I think most of the traditions, certainly that I've come across here at NYU, have those resources there. Otherwise, I don't think students who didn't have those resources in their traditions would apply to come here. They wouldn't want to be here.
And I also think that on this issue specifically, it always strikes me as like a deeper question that's like getting to the heart of what we do at a university, because I think, with the way we communicate now through the internet and often faceless communication, I think that like true sustained deep dialogue is rarer and rarer. Even as I think we encounter more diversity, our encounters with that are more fleeting than our encounters with people previously. And so one of the projects that we work on, but like how do you engage with someone who's different than you repeatedly on a sustained basis over the course of years and really learn to understand them and say, like, I still think you're wrong? Because that's actually like a really important life skill. Like, that's going to come up in a relationship, that's going to come up with children, that's going to come up with coworkers. Like, that happens to be a pretty important thing to be able to do in life regardless of what your beliefs are. I don't know if I'm particularly good at it, frankly, but like, I don't know if universities are really kind of pushing that, and that strikes me as actually a pretty countercultural and important thing to develop.
And I would say what's interesting is, so the university is really good at equipping people with how to think and mm-hmm. what ideas to have. What you're describing, I would say, as a philosopher, are not just ideas and beliefs, but virtues, right? They are habits, postures, dispositions that you have to cultivate, and those you sort of learn by practice, learn by doing, not just thinking your way to some conclusion. And when David said, you know, it's about making room, I mean, what we're really talking about is how do you learn the virtue of hospitality, where we can welcome people into spaces and conversations without demanding that they conform to mm-hmm. ours or that we accede to theirs. I think that kind of habit formation is exactly what the university needs to be more holistic to be concerned about that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the university is the only place that does that. It's actually why I think it's, I don't want this to be too scandalous, but I actually think religious communities are often better at making pluralist citizens than the alternative, because there's such an intentionality about formation that sort of bears fruit.
Yeah. Well, I think, especially when it comes to like feeling the need to build sustained community around a set of issues, and even knowing that people within the community might disagree, I think that strikes me as very true. Just experiences that I've had inviting people who aren't from organized religious group to like a Shabbat dinner at my apartment or things like that, and seeing the type of community that I have through my Judaism, they're often very jealous of it. And the Jews I know are very diverse and have lots of infighting. You know, it's all as you would imagine. But it's really complicated. And I think I have also a great story to kind of cap what we're saying is last year we took a group of students to Abu Dhabi over spring break to learn about religion and spirituality in Abu Dhabi and how Abu Dhabi campus is working with religious diversity and how that relates to NYU becoming a global university. And one of the students on the trip was an evangelical Christian student named Peter. And at one point, we're sitting next to each other on the bus, and he's like, "Do you think it's possible for someone who has an exclusive truth claim to like really do interfaith dialogue?" And I turned to him, and I was like, "Peter, you literally just flew halfway around the world to be on this trip with me. I'm pretty sure you're doing it." And so that was like a good moment for that, the two of us shared. But I think it's a good example of what you're talking about,
absolutely,
how kind of the atmosphere and the hospitality can lead to those conversations organically.
It's great.
Well, thank you so much for coming. This
thanks
has been really
me.
Fun.
It's great fun.
David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for coming to the Veritas Forum at NYU last
night. Yeah, it was my
great.
Pleasure. It was great fun.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Listening to another episode of Multi Faithful. Especially thank you to our guest, Jamie Smith, for giving us so much time this morning and for his lecture at NYU the night before we recorded this. Thank you to Trevor, who you didn't hear on the podcast, but he was sitting in the corner contributing to the conversation, and for being an awesome chaplain and partner on campus, and to David for joining us on the podcast and being a chaplain representative of our office. Special thank you to Brian Young for editing and producing the podcast in absentia. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes, and we hope to have you back for another episode next week.